This is Jim Inkster. Coming today on the show, we are slated to hear from the Bishop of Baton Rouge, Robert Munch, about Inauguration Day for Pope Francis. Also, former lawmaker Melissa Flournoy and former Health Secretary David Hood, who's substituting for another former Health Secretary, Fred Cerise, on Medicaid reform and the governor's refusal to accept the plan outlined in the Affordable Care Plan. We'll talk with them about Governor Jindal's next move and whether he can change his mind on this. Also on the show, satirist Roy Zimmerman appearing tonight at the Unitarian Church in Baton Rouge, always topical. And we'll hear from composer David Lang, Pulitzer Prize winner, who's making a stop at LSU. All this, but now the news on 89.3 WRKF. This is Jim Inkster. You are listening to 89.3 WRKF in Baton Rouge. 297-5633 is your number outside the area, 877-217-5757. And you may reach us by email, inkstershow@wrkf.org. Two former Louisiana health secretaries are pushing for expanding Medicaid in the state to cover thousands of uninsured residents. That pits them against Republican Governor Bobby Jindal. David Hood was Secretary of the Department of Health and Hospitals under Mike Foster. I think he actually succeeded Bobby Jindal in that role. And he is with us, substituting for Fred Cerise. They're on the same page, along with former lawmaker and chair of the board of Louisiana Progress, Melissa Flournoy. David Hood, what's your assessment on the governor's position on this?
Well, I would like to see the governor change his mind and move forward with a Medicaid expansion. I think that's just what we need in Louisiana. We've got something on the order of 750,000 people who are uninsured. That's quite a large percentage for this state, and we need to do something about it. This is the best opportunity we've ever had.
Now, you worked with the governor at the Department of Health and then succeeded him as the secretary, and David, of course, is now with the Public Affairs Research Council, has been for a few years as their chief health care analyst. Does it surprise you that the governor's taken this stance?
Well, I would not have predicted that 10 years or so ago. I would think that he would have moved forward with the expansion. But over the last 5 years, with he in the governor's seat, I guess I've become accustomed to this. I think it's a very, very conservative sort of position that he's taken on this, and I don't think he's going to change.
Are you surprised that his change in philosophy seems to be more ideological now, and you knew a more pragmatic person? At least that's the sense I'm getting from you.
Yeah, I did indeed. We worked very closely together. I was the undersecretary. He was secretary. And at that time, 24 years old, I think he did a wonderful job getting the budget in order and doing a lot of other positive things for the department and the state. And much more pragmatic he was at that time.
And you speak as a person who in the past, on interviews with me and others, you've been, as you just were, very forthcoming in praise for him during his tenure as Secretary of the Department of Health. But he has drawn a line in the sand, and sometimes when politicians do that, whether it's Governor Jindal or anybody else, it's hard to undo that line. And is he in a box now where if he even wanted to change his mind, he would have difficulty doing so?
I think that's true. It won't be an easy sell for him, and I think that you know, we're going to win over some of the legislators. Some being Republican. Just this past week, I heard from one or two of them that they've changed their mind and think this is a good idea. But I think that's going to be a tough sell for the governor.
Now, Bruce Greenstein, who is the health secretary and works at the pleasure of Governor Jindal, says ultimately the program as it exists is unsustainable. Is that a fair statement?
I don't think so.
Why not?
Well, we've had the math done on this several different ways and by several different organizations, both within and without Louisiana. And their bottom line, basically, is that it's going to cost the state something like over a 10-year period, $1.2 billion. That's the projection by the Kaiser Commission on Medicaid and the Uninsured. It's a nonpartisan organization, and they do this all the time. And for Louisiana, they've done it for all 50 states, and for Louisiana, $1.2 billion over 10 years. That's not much. We've got the Medicaid program has grown over the past 2 years, almost $1 billion. In Louisiana, and that's a lot of money. That's just a fraction.
And Melissa Flournoy is also with us, former state lawmaker from Shreveport and chair of the board of Louisiana Progress. What's your assessment? I think I know, but are you going to echo just what Secretary Hood said?
Well, yes, but Jim, I'm going to echo what you said too. I think we really need to try and find a way to help Governor Jindal paint himself out of the corner. I mean, he's painted himself into the corner, and I think there's an opportunity here for the legislature and the hospital association and the medical society and even the parties to these cooperative endeavor groups to help the governor sort of see the light, that he's made a decision that ideology trumps practicality. But I think we've got to be practical and pragmatic. Medicaid and the expansion of Medicaid can be the source of resources that will make this cooperative endeavor agreement partnership with private hospitals functional. Without the Medicaid expansion, we have sort of a recipe for the dismantling of healthcare because there are no resources. And so, you know, it's a complicated issue, but I think we've really got to help the governor sort of see how this is in his personal and political best interest.
297-5633 to join Melissa Flournoy and David Hood. Charles on North Foster. Hello, Charles. You're on the air.
Good morning, Jim. Good morning to you. Yes, I heard you, Jim, say that the governor was in a box. I'm trying to understand, as he can't run for governor anymore, so what box is he in? I mean, he is the governor of Louisiana, so I don't want him thinking about anything else. And then my second question for you, guess, is how many people – let's set aside the dollars and cents. How many people are going to actually suffer and die? I'm talking men, women, and children, if we fail to implement this Medicaid expansion, because this is a human issue first and then a budget issue.
All right.
Well, I'll jump on that one, Charles, because I agree with you. I think that Governor Jindal is very good about seeing the zeros on a spreadsheet and is not good about seeing the consequences for people. We've already seen reported in the newspapers, and I think Dr. Cerise even told a story in the Atlantic magazine about a person not being able to access health care and died. There was recently a woman trying to access health care through Women's Hospital, was not able to get the surgery, and subsequently died. So, yeah, I think that there are going to be many, many families who are going to have health care crises as a result of the dismantling of the public hospital system, the lack of expansion of Medicaid, and the human toll, unfortunately, I think is going to pile up if we don't sort of really look at this more comprehensively about what's the impact on people. And
Kaiser Foundation says it would cost Louisiana $1.2 billion over 10 years, but in exchange, $15.8 billion in federal funding. You just said the governor is good at looking at zeros. There are a lot of zeros that would seem to be on the plus side for this. So the governor is a smart man. He can add and subtract, David Hood. What is the reason why he would avoid accepting this money from the government?
Well, I think only the governor can really answer that question. Some people have speculated that he's looking down the road at 2016 or so in a presidential run and so on. And maybe this is what the conservative base wants him to do. It's hard for me to say. But I certainly agree with Melissa that, you know, this is not just a dollars and cents issue. It's a moral issue as well. You know, when you're looking at improving the healthcare system, the first place you look is what can we do about coverage? Can we get universal mm-hmm. coverage? This is close to it. This is what we need.
And the 400,000 or so people who are in the gap on this, many of them are working. It's not like they're deadbeats who don't want to pay their freight. Many of them are working. They just would welcome the opportunity to have some resources to help them if they need health care.
Absolutely. And, you know, let me point out that Louisiana is at the bottom in terms of the eligibility standards for these people. If a person, if an individual makes more than $1,500 a year in Louisiana, they can't be eligible for Medicaid. Mm-hmm. That's way below the 100% threshold on the poverty level. So, mm-hmm. you know, if you make any money at all, you can't be eligible.
Well, the governor has he set up a situation in which he could deal on this. He could accept the Medicaid money in addition for what in exchange for lawmakers accepting his tax swap. It would be interesting to see, or will be, what happens next month when they convene at the Capitol. I think we're going to have a lot of evolution on the tax front, and we may have a change of heart on the Medicaid front.
Well, I would hope so. I mean, if you look at Florida, Republican governor there has changed his mind. Now, he's got to get the legislature to go along with him, but nevertheless, Governor Rick Scott has changed his mind. The governor, Jan Brewer in Arizona, has changed her mind on this issue. There's been about five or six.
Chris Christie changed his mind mm-hmm. reluctantly, but he did it.
Kasich's in Ohio, the guy up in South Dakota. You know, the people I think are, you know, governors around the country, both Democrat and Republican, are focusing on what's good for their state,
that's
you
right.
know, and on what's good for their people. And basically our pitch is we want to ask Governor Jindal to focus on what's good for Louisiana. And frankly, Jim, I'm afraid of the tax swap for Medicaid because two wrongs don't make a right. And so we've really – this is an attack on the working people
well,
in Louisiana right now.
That's what politics is all about, though, Representative Flournoy. Sometimes you have to give on something to get what you want. And in order for you to get Medicaid reform, as the federal government has outlined, you, if you were still in the state legislature, might have to give something back to the governor.
Well, I actually think that the legislature will stop the tax swap. I don't see anybody in the 250 clergy folks that signed the letter yesterday and that were at the steps of the Capitol. We're talking about the regressive tax structure and the sales
That's
tax
the way
increase
you look at it.
And all of that. Oh, absolutely. But I think that there are mm-hmm. enough sane people in the legislature that they're going to have to get some better data. They were.
So are you saying somebody's insane if they accept this?
I'm saying that we need better information and data, and we need to have a robust discussion. I'm hoping the legislators learned from last year's education debate that they need to read the bills. They need to know what they're voting on.
Judy on Highway 44. Judy, you're on the air. Please be brief.
Okay, good morning. I guess I'm just appalled at the fact that I now have to encourage my children to leave the state in order to do something better with themselves because of the choices our politicians are making. And as a working person who's working a 40-hour week and two extra jobs with no health insurance, it's nice to know I'm nothing more than a number if I drop dead because I'm working and can't get insurance.
Judy speaks for more than a few people, Secretary Hood.
Well, she certainly does. And as I said earlier, you know, coverage in healthcare is like the law of gravity. I mean, we have total disorder without, covering a fair amount of people. And the goal has always been, as far as I'm concerned, has always been universal coverage. And Louisiana and the United States fall far behind on that particular item.
297-5633 is your number, 877-217-5757, wherever you are. And we will return, spend a few more minutes with David Hood and Melissa Flournoy, and then hear from the Pulitzer Prize-winning composer, David Lang, who is at LSU. Back after this 90-second pause. This is Jim Inkster. You are listening to 89.3 WRKF in Baton Rouge. A few more minutes with former Secretary of Health David Hood, now a top numbers cruncher and healthcare analyst for the Public Affairs Research Council, and Melissa Flournoy, former state lawmaker who is head of Louisiana Progress, and I understand soon to be head of Louisiana Planned Parenthood. Is that correct?
Yes, I'm the state director for Planned Parenthood here in Louisiana.
Why isn't there some big announcement on this? It's happened in the last few days, it must have.
Well, no, it's happened in the last month, and I'm just getting my feet wet, and I'd be happy to come back on and talk about Planned Parenthood at another time.
Okay, but Melissa, for at least a little while longer, is chair of Louisiana Progress. Are you going to stay with that organization?
Well, I'm going to stay on the board. I'm going to stay on the board for Louisiana Progress, and I think there are a lot of opportunities here in Louisiana, and so I'm excited about what we're trying to do.
Paul in Opelousas. Paul, you're on the air. Please be brief.
All right. Hey, Jim, how you doing? Just a quick question. Can the legislative body overrule or beat or decline the proposed tax proposal by the governor, and can they accept the monies from Medicaid as a body and overrule the governor? Thank you very much.
The legislature can defeat the tax policy that the governor is proposing, and I actually think they will, or they will amend it significantly. And the legislature can vote to take the Medicaid expansion. The governor then could veto it, and the legislature could attempt to override that veto. But I think that's how we got LaChip. The legislature passed a bill directing the Department of Health and Hospitals to do the child health insurance program back in the late 90s and to expand LaChip, which was a very successful project here in Louisiana to cover children.
And I might add that the Louisiana Children's Health Insurance Program had widespread support, including Governor Foster. So, that was the key to its success, is nobody was against health care coverage for children. And now that we're looking at health care coverage for adults, it seems to be a different story. I think that's a shame. Adults need health care, too.
Well, and Bobby Jindal was still with the Department of Health when that was taking place, wasn't it?
He had already left, and I made a few changes that he did not make, and we had and still have one of the most successful CHIP programs in the entire United States. We rank seventh in the nation.
Well, the governor has already refused money for broadband from the federal government. He refused money for the expansion of rail system, Baton Rouge to New Orleans. This is not inconsistent with other moves he's made. Why is this one causing such grief for people like you who think it's just a terrible thing, David Hood?
Well, as I said earlier, I think coverage is what it's all about. The more people you can provide health care coverage for, the better off we're going to be as a society, as an economy. It's going to be a tremendous advantage as far as I'm concerned.
Well, I want to come back to Judy, because Judy is the person that Medicare expansion will help. And the caller who said she was working three jobs, she's got kids, she can't afford insurance. You know, the Medicaid expansion, it helps working people in Louisiana who are not now covered. And so these are folks that are going to show up at the emergency room, at our private hospitals, without any funding source. And if we took the Medicaid expansion, we would have some resources to continue to fund our healthcare delivery system. And so I think the governor is making penny-wise and pound-foolish choices.
Well, thank you, Melissa Flournoy, and thank you, David Hood. I must say the governor at this point doesn't have a whole lot of surrogates speaking on his behalf on this issue, but if some prominent person is out there who wants to speak on behalf of the governor and attempt to counter them that were made today by Melissa Flournoy and David Hood, we welcome the other side on this particular issue. Thank you.
Thank you.
297-5633 is your number, and in just a moment, we're going to visit with the Pulitzer Prize-winning composer, David Lang, who will be at LSU, and he's here to talk about his career and his appearance. David Lang will be composing, as he does, the 2008 Pulitzer Prize winner for music for the Little Match Girl Passion. Born on January 8th, birthday of Elvis Presley and Shirley Bassey, a few years later in Los Angeles, and he is in Baton Rouge. Good morning to you.
Good morning. How are you?
I'm doing well. This is a place that has awaited your arrival for some time. The LSU School of Music, of course, is one of the best in the United States.
Yes, I'm very happy to be here. I'm very excited. I've been working with the students and just in general talking about music all day long. It's been really fun.
And you're a man who has taught at other universities.
I teach at Yale right now, which is great, and I've taught all over the place. I really believe that it's, you know, one of your jobs as a musician to help younger musicians figure it out.
Now, your music has been described in many ways. How would you describe it?
Nice. You know, we have this idea that classical music is about you know, violins and old things, and there's a lot of great repertoire that's already been written, which is great. But I think that being a musician, if you look at it as kind of like a tool that you have to investigate the world around you, then you end up making music which is loud and soft and fast and beautiful and ugly and, you know, aggressive and sensuous. You know, I really want the world, the everything that's in the world to be something that's, you know, appropriate in my music. So basically, well, I'm having a lot of fun.
You've done well. Named Musical America's 2013 Composer of the Year, David Lang's music has been described as comic, abrasive, soothing, totalist.
Yeah, I don't know what that means.
Well,
but,
it sounds good anyway. You had a piece called Eating Live Monkeys.
Oh, yeah.
What was that?
Oh, that was, you know, when you're young, this is the long story of this, which I'll take, which is like half a minute, which is, you know, it's like you're a young composer, and we study all these great pieces from the past. You know, we love Beethoven, mm-hmm. we love Brahms and Bach and all this, and you think your job as a young composer is to write masterpieces immediately. So when I was young, I got this great commission from the Cleveland Orchestra, and it was really exciting. And I just thought, if I think it's my job to write a masterpiece that's serious, that's going to change people's minds about culture, I'm never going to get this piece done. So I just thought I'm going to make this into a ridiculous project, and somehow I was able to do it.
Well, the 2008 Pulitzer Prize in Music, that's strong stuff. And how did that come about?
I was commissioned by Carnegie Hall to work with a great choral singer and a great choral ensemble. And one of the things that's interesting in Western music is that a lot of our music comes from the church, right? Everything, you know, came mm-hmm. from the early years of the Catholic Church, and there's a huge amount of worship of Jesus in Western music, which is fantastic, and you hear how passionate Bach is about it. The strange thing for me is, as much as a classical music nerd as I am, I'm not Christian. I'm Jewish. And so so for people like me, you have to figure out where your avenue is into this Christian repertoire. So what I did for that piece was I thought, you know, the thing that's really essential to me about the story of the Gospels is noticing the suffering of someone happening in front of you and using that suffering to challenge you to become a better person. So what I thought I could do with that piece, The Little Match Girl Passion, which we heard a little bit of in the transition, was to take the story of Jesus out of the Gospels and put someone else's suffering in, and then notice it sort of in the same gospel story. So so I took the story of the Little Match Girl of Hans Christian mm-hmm. Andersen.
Well, tonight you'll be with the LSU Wind Ensemble and conductor Donald McKinney, 7:30 to 9 p.m., and I'm sure you're excited, but I would think Donald and his crew and all the people who'll be on hand are probably more excited about having David Lang on hand. You are recognized as you should be, as one of the best in the world at what you do.
Thank you.
And I've got a question here from a listener who obviously knows a bit about you, and it was about an opera that you did in 1999. I'm looking, it was called The Difficulty of Crossing a Field.
Right.
Yeah. What was that about?
It's a story written originally by Ambrose Bierce, who is someone who was a great American writer from the 19th century. And he wrote a story about a Southern plantation owner during the time of slavery,
right,
who disappears in plain view of everyone in his community. And no one ever finds out what happens to him. The story is half a page long. And his absence kind of destroys all of the relationships of all of the people who are there. So that's mm-hmm. what the opera's about.
What's the status of classical music right now in this country?
Well, you know, it's in flux at this moment. You know, we have all the big ticket places are all nervous about all the money. You know, it's like the orchestras are all very nervous. So there's one way to look at it, that the institutions are all really, confused about what's coming. But the flip side of it is that we've never had better musicians in this country, and we've never had better composers, and we've never had more excitement among young composers and young performers. Mm-hmm. So I think that there's actually a huge amount of activity going on. It just might not it might not be in the places where we're used to looking for it.
So what's next for you?
I'm actually finishing a concerto right now for this great percussion ensemble called So Percussion, which is going to be premiering in London in 2 months.
Wow.
And then I have another opera, which is premiering in Chicago and New York in a few months, called The Whisper Opera, mm-hmm. which is so quiet that you have to be sitting right next to everybody or you're not going to hear it.
You still live in Los Angeles?
No, I live in New York now. I've lived in New York for 30 years.
So you moved from one coast to the other.
I did.
But your upbringing in Los Angeles must have had a great deal to do with who you are and what you've done.
Yeah, it was great there. And, you know, everything there revolves around the film industry, at least when I was a kid, mm-hmm. you know. So, but it was so beautiful to be there. I love going back.
Well, David Lang, a Pulitzer Prize-winning composer. Do we have a bit more of his work, Kevin? Let's hear from David. And David Lang, tonight, 7:30 with the LSU Wind Ensemble. If you'd like more information, you may call the College of Music and Dramatic Arts at 578-3925. That's 225-578-3925. Thank you, sir. It's an honor to share the microphone.
Thank you so much for having me.
My pleasure, and hope you enjoy your stay in Baton Rouge. And good luck with your opera, and my goodness, you got a lot going in 2013. And we're joined now by another gentleman who is a different kind of performer, one of the world's best-known satirists, Roy Zimmerman, who's been with us before. Funny songs about ignorance, war, and greed, that's his...
From the sublime to the ridiculous, don't you think?
You said it, I didn't. But Roy, if you're not going to the appearance at LSU from David Lang, Roy will be at the Unitarian Church on Goodwood tonight, where he stops about once a year. And good morning to you, Roy.
Good morning, Jim.
Well, we live in a funny world, don't we?
Constantly, yes, we do.
What do you find most entertaining about the people in the world, particularly those who are at the highest levels of the political apparatus?
Well, the kind of songs I'm writing demand that I observe the absurdity that's going on, and there's always plenty of that in supply. these days and in all days, really, you know. Sometimes I think that the things get so absurd that it's hard to write a satire because reality has outdistanced it.
Well, Roy is a guy who does satire about as well as anybody who's around these days, and he's done a lot of it how many years have you been doing this, Roy?
I've been doing it for 20 plus years.
20-plus years. And, of course, that goes back to the Clinton years. And like him or loathe him, he was a funny guy.
There was a lot. Yeah, exactly. There was a lot. There was a dance going on then. I wrote a dance song back then called Do the Clinton about leaning to the left and leaning to the right and, you know, and taking an awkward position and so forth.
Okay, well, let's get listen to some of Roy Zimmerman's work.
In the good book. I want a marriage like they had in the Bible. They had in the Bible. They had in the Bible. I want a marriage like they had in the Bible. Because the Bible tells me so.
All right, we got the bishop coming next, so I don't know if we ought to go to, much longer with that, but no target is unavailable for you, Roy.
That's true. You know, I try to choose the right target. That's the thing, and I try to imbue the songs with, you know, with analysis too, so that they're not just pot shots. You know, that there's some kind of thought behind them, and maybe even analysis of what we can do better.
Well, Roy Zimmerman will be at the Unitarian Church tonight. If you'd like to join us in our remaining moments with him, 297-5633 is your number. Who's the funniest political person you've ever covered in your 20 years of being on the grand stage?
I used to say Newt Gingrich was the greatest satirist of the 20th century. But then it turned out that he meant all that stuff. you know, in order to be to function at that level of government and so forth, you kind of have a certain kind of a hubris anyway. I think there's a certain kind of a megalomania that drives to that level of government anyway. So they're all funny, you know. Mitch McConnell is hilarious, and you know, and obviously the Clintons, both of them are funny in their way then too. But the deal is that it's not so much about the personalities these days. I think it's about the issues that people really care about. Finding the humor in that kind of a thing is where I think the satire can do important work then, too, help people work through these issues.
Well, as you know, sometimes people are funny without trying to be. Sometimes they're trying not to be funny, and we're laughing.
yeah. Well, there's the laughing with and the laughing at, isn't there?
You got it. 297-5633 is your number. Outside the area, 877-217-5757. We'll be back and spend a few more minutes with Roy Zimmerman, and then we'll hear from the Honorable Bishop Robert Munch of Baton Rouge back after this 90-second pause on WRKM. This is Jim Inkster. You're listening to 89.3 WRKF in Baton Rouge, one of the world's most funny men. Roy Zimmerman, satirist, will be at the Unitarian Church tonight. We're wrapping up our discussion with him, and Bishop Robert Munch is with us in just a moment. But after tonight, to give you an idea of Roy's brisk schedule, he goes to Birmingham, then Atlanta, Chattanooga. After that, Charleston, West Virginia, Lynchburg, Virginia, Chapel Hill, Wilmington, North Carolina, Baltimore, Philadelphia, Newark. It never stops for you, does it?
It doesn't really. No, our home away from home is home. That's the way I think of it.
What are you going to focus on tonight?
Well, you know, I'm going to focus on these social issues that I'm talking about. You know, we've had the election. The election is over, and so electoral politics is not really on the plate so much anymore for people. I think people just want to see what happens with the second Obama administration. And what it means for their lives, you know, right? So the issues of health care, the issues of education, these important issues, and you know, same-sex marriage is coming up in front of the Supreme Court then too, these are all important issues that have people's attention now, I think.
Well, I think it's good for all of us of whatever our political stripes to laugh at the people we admire.
Absolutely. I've got one foot in comedy and one foot in folk music and another foot in politics. I have 3 feet is what I'm trying to say. I'll bring them all to the Unitarian Church tonight.
All right. Thank you, Roy Zimmerman. Let's do it again soon. It's always a pleasure.
You bet.
Take care.
Thanks so much, Jim.
My pleasure. We're joined now by Bishop Robert Munch of Baton Rouge. In 2000, 1962, he was installed as the fifth bishop of Baton Rouge. Pope John Paul II appointed Robert Munch to this position, and he has spent much of his life in the state of Louisiana. Good morning to you, Bishop Munch.
Good morning, Jim, and good morning to all of your listeners.
And this is a big day for the world at large and for the 1.2 billion Roman Catholics. It is inauguration day for the Pope.
Absolutely, and he had the Mass of inauguration already in Rome, and it was a splendid celebration.
What does that mean to the Catholic flock in the Diocese of Baton Rouge?
Well, it's a new start, but it's a start that has continuity, strong continuity with the past, and it's an opportunity for us to reflect on who we are as Catholics and what we're called to be and to do. And the Holy Father has given us a great living image of how we are to care for and serve the poor and how we are to reach out and to assist other people, among other, he mentioned in his homily earlier today that we also are to be protectors of the environment. So he covered a number of bases.
Well, Pope Francis, at the age of 76, is the first non-European pope in 1,200 years and the first Jesuit. He is breaking some barriers, isn't he?
He certainly is. There are a number of firsts, and so he brings a freshness, if you will, to a timeless message. And I believe he also is an inspiring person because that first impression that he made and continuing impressions, what a very person he is, man he is, of God, of the church, and of the people. And I think his identification, not only with Catholics, but others, has been very strong from the very beginning.
We're visiting with Bishop Robert William Munch of Baton Rouge. He's been the bishop here for, hard to believe now, you just had your 11th anniversary, didn't you?
11 years.
Wow. HB in Denham Springs. HB, you're on the air with Bishop Munch.
Good morning. Bishop, a quick question here about our new pope. It's been said, or I think it's my understanding, that his position is trying to turn things around from the moral and ethical junkyard that many perceive us to live in, as in the gay and the lesbian community and the legalization of marriage that's been adopted by many states. Is he really trying to change these things around to back to what the teachings of the Bible say?
Well, he is a strong and continuously connected leader from what the church has and does and will always teach. So he is faithful to Christ. He's faithful to the church. He's faithful to the church tradition. And we as Catholic Christians take the scripture and Jesus as our source and the 2,000 years of understanding what Jesus has taught and how that applies to our world today, and we have a requirement to be faithful to that. The Pope is the leading example of that, but all of us, we are not in a situation to change the basic teachings of Jesus himself. That's what a faith or a religion is, based on certain principles and truths and teachings as they are understood. And while the incidentals can be changed, the essentials cannot.
Bishop, do you think there's a place in the church for people who believe, for example, they might believe in abortion rights? They might not get an abortion or advise somebody to have one, but they believe if it's somebody wants to have that choice, it should be theirs, and it's really a state matter rather than a church matter. Is that an acceptable point of view in the church?
Well, we are very clear about the consistent ethic of life from conception to natural death. And we deal with both sides of this question. First of all, the conception question, and as well as the end of life issues, both with regard to euthanasia and capital punishment. And there are some people that don't prefer some of our stands on one side or the other. We are across the board. It is authentically Catholic for us to be against an abortion. Those who have made a mistake in this regard can be forgiven and be brought back to unity in the church. But so can someone who committed a heinous crime. So to be authentically Catholic is not to pick and choose what we like of essential issues. It requires a fidelity to teaching. And we live in a world that oftentimes, it seems to me, Jim, that does not understand the difference between a religion or a faith tradition and, let's say, a political party, where a political party can evolve about what it chooses to emulate and support. We have to be faithful. If we're not faithful to Christ and the tradition of the church, then we're not the church.
But would you ever refuse communion to, let's say, a public official who on the record is in favor of abortion rights but is a practicing Roman Catholic?
Well, I've never been in that position before, and it's a rare bishop that chooses to do that. I'm responsible for the 230,000 Catholics in our diocese, and that's more than enough to handle.
Yeah, you're right. You've got 230,000 people. That's a substantial part of this community. And, of course, the Catholic Church has had its challenges, as you know.
Right.
How have those 230,000 people been affected? Has their faith been rocked by these scandals that have enveloped the church?
This diocese, founded in 1961 when John 23rd was pope, and, of course, which goes back over 200 years before it was an absolute diocese, its own particular diocese, have been people of resilient and strong faith. And so just like the apostles in the boat, when the boat started rocking at times, the winds and the waves came up, we looked to Jesus to calm the waters and to protect and support us and to guide us through his Holy Spirit. So I believe I am so proud of the Catholics and others who work with us, and we work with them in this area. It's a wonderful place to be, and we have wonderful human beings that are part of this area.
We're visiting with Bishop Robert Munch of Baton Rouge, 11 years on the job now, the fifth bishop of Baton Rouge. The Pope is from Argentina. Latin America has four out of 10 of every Catholic living on the planet lives in Latin America. It's somewhat of an appropriate move, isn't it?
Well, the Spirit is alive and well, and as often it has been said, we have a God of surprises. So from my reading of the pundits going into the election, I really did not hear Pope Francis's name being mentioned as a candidate. But after he emerged and you learn more about him, you can see why. What a wonderful choice, not only for his background, but for the person he is and for that simplicity and humility of lifestyle. I believe that that's a very important thing, that we put God first in our life and things second. And he not only teaches that, he lives that, he emulates that, he demonstrates that.
Bishop Robert Munch was the Bishop of Covington for 6 years prior to becoming bishop in Baton Rouge. Born in Louisville, which, by the way, is also the hometown of the new LSU president, soon to be president, F. King Alexander. Bishop Munch, you were ordained in 1968.
Correct.
So we're to be 45 years and 2 months.
You must have gotten straight A's in math.
Well, 45 years, May 18th, 1968, you were ordained two weeks before Bobby Kennedy was shot in Los Angeles. Lots changed in the Catholic Church in those 45 years. What have been the biggest changes?
Well, I think the outreach for the pastoral approach in the church has increased significantly. The involvement of lay people, and from the time of our first bishop, Bishop Tracy, this has been eminently clear that the role of laity in the church, as well as religious and clergy, is very significant. And we depend so much on the cooperation, the service of people, lay faithful who are in office in various, the diocesan level, at the parish level, at various agencies that we have, plus the volunteerism that is so prominent. So we have that aspect, and we also have a deep thirst in people to learn Jesus, to learn the Scripture, to learn how they can be faithful and to learn how they can serve. And this through prayer and the good works that we do. For example, in our community, we have a magnificent St. Vincent de Paul Society, both at the diocesan level and the parish level. Our Catholic Charities is just outstanding. And when we have had local crises through hurricanes, for example, these agencies and people who just came out to serve, what they did was just phenomenal. And that's just a characteristic example of who the laity here in our diocese are, led by, in many ways, clergy, religious, and lay leaders.
Do you think the church evolves on these social issues which occasionally divide us, or is it a case in which the church has a position and it's not going to change no matter how long we live?
Well, in terms of serving people, loving people, accepting people, that is there. But to accept changes in various institutions and various policies and considered truths of the church, if something is considered an essential truth in the church, again, it's not subject to modification and or basic change. So people who are looking, I heard one commentator on television say that, who indicated he was not Catholic, but he said it seemed like some people were surprised that the cardinals elected a Catholic to be Pope. And I think so sometimes people may have some unrealistic expectations about what the church is and what it can do and only will do if in accord with Jesus, the scriptures, and Catholic, authentic Catholic tradition.
I can hear the enthusiasm in your voice. What gets you started every morning?
Well, I am so excited, and I say this genuinely, and I was unexpectedly moved, specially moved, when we were able to see the new Holy Father come to the balcony. And there was something about his presence that we were assembled, some of our workers in the Catholic Life Center, in one of our conference rooms, and it just really touched me very, very powerfully. And I believe it touched others, and not only those of the Catholic faith, but what I've been noticing, Jim, is that in my going around from here and there, people who are not Catholic are asking questions about the Pope, about the Church, and so it's almost, in a small way, like a new Pentecost. You know, that original Pentecost had a matter of hundreds of followers of Jesus who were awaiting the gift of the Holy Spirit, who came, and the church started 2,000 years ago so small and has grown, as you mentioned, to 1.2 billion Catholics around the world now.
And the first pope was?
Peter.
St. Peter. That's,
correct.
That's the Peter in the Bible.
That's correct, Simon Peter. And you know, when we look at Simon Peter and we see Simon Peter was a leader, and sometimes he was impetuous. And that impetuosity at times would get him in trouble. But there was a depth about him through that rough fisherman's skin that Jesus saw him and named him, "You are Peter, and upon this rock I will build my church." And so Peter didn't always, he struck out sometimes, to use a baseball analogy, but in the end he was a winner for Christ and died for Christ.
We only have about 30 seconds, but why did you become a priest?
I became a priest because, first of all, when I was young and in elementary school, the priests were so wonderful to us young people and treated us like we were human beings. And they touched my life in a very positive way, and I never thought I could and I never would be able to be as good as them, but I saw their joy, and I wanted to follow where they gave the example.
Well, thanks for spending time with us. Congratulations on 11 years as bishop, and we all wish the new Pope Francis the very best. Thank you, Bishop.
Jim, I thank you, and I thank your listeners as well. Right. God bless.
God bless you. And thank you for listening, everybody. Until tomorrow, for Kevin Gallagher, I'm Jim Engster. Stay tuned.
Podcasts of The Jim Engster Show are available at WRKF.org. The Jim Engster Show is produced in association with the Louisiana Radio Network and is copyrighted by WRKF for the private use of its audience. Any other use of any portion of this program without the written consent of WRKF is prohibited. The views expressed on this program are those of the participants and do not necessarily reflect the views of WRKF, its officers, and members.